Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. So essentially how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much in the way you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discover that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best, we plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you very much for providing us with that disclaimer. I was asked a curious question the other day on a call, and the question was, what are some rights that we have as Americans that we enjoy today that perhaps the colonists did not have back in the mid to latter 1700s? And I replied to them, none. There are none. The absolute raw naked power our founding fathers memorialized in the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America for independence, the Northwest Ordinance, the Articles of Confederation, and a constitution for the United States of America cannot ever be diminished or demolished with the exception of establishing a new constitutional convention. And today there are men and women actively pursuing to create a CONCON, that's the short for constitutional convention. So far, I think 34 states of the 37 or 8 states required have already signed up for it. And if it hits 37 or 38, there can be a new constitutional convention. And that, to me, is frightening beyond all fears, all concerns. So why are the rights and the same as they were in the mid to latter 1700s? And the answer is because these words did not create our rights and immunities to begin with. These rights and immunities pre-existed the founding of our nation. Go to the scripture that you read on the Liberty Bell, and it's quoting from the book of Leviticus. It's at Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10. It reads, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." The Liberty Bell is a huge bronze bell that symbolizes freedom in the United States of America. Now, why would the colonists be interested in ringing a bell that has a Bible verse on it? And what was the basis for this declaration? And why would a group of politicians think it was so important that a bell should have a Bible verse crafted on it and displayed? Who were those that founded our nation to begin with? Quote, "From a small group of Christians in the north of England who had decided that the creator of the universe had placed the longing for liberty in the heart of man, and that liberty would first be experienced by those free and self-determined through the worship of the Almighty One," end quote. The scriptures are all about liberty. These colonists took the scriptures literally. They truly believed that the Almighty One had delivered Israel out of Egypt. They truly believed that the Almighty One had promised Israel a promised land. They truly believed that Yeshua, the Messiah, who most everyone calls the Christ Jesus, had come to set men free from the tyranny of sin and its slavery. Reference John chapter 8, verses 31 and 32. Quote, Then Yahushua said to those Jews who believed him, quote, if you abide in my word, and you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, end quote. Simply stated, our founding fathers saw self-government originating in the scriptures. Our founding fathers memorialized these freedoms found in the scriptures in our founding documents, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America for independence, the Northwest Ordinance, the Articles of Confederation, and a constitution for the United States of America. So back to the question, what rights, what are some rights that we as Americans today enjoy that maybe the colonists did not have back in the mid to late 1700s? Well, as you all know, because you're here, and you may share with others that I host this teleconference call at Freedoms Radio and also on the phone lines here. And we deal with the topic of jurisdiction, to which your question strikes, to the very heart of the matter. And this is pretty much the thoughts that I share with our students. In the beginning, we the people, acknowledging the Almighty One as our sovereign and creator, and we, man, his creation, came together first as colonists, then as state citizens, organizing our respective state governments through our voice, that is, our state constitutions. We ordered our states to create a federal zone, quote, 10 miles within the seat of power, all territories, possessions, and enclaves, end quote. You will find this at Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. This was formalized in 1789. The Almighty One, man, man's creation in that order. That was the pecking order of things. The creator of the universe was on top. His creation, man, was next. And then whatever man created was third. Remember the universal rule. The created is never equal to or greater than its creator. Then in 1871, man's creation, the House of Representatives and the Senate, collectively called the Congress, created the Act of 1871. These two houses, already enjoying a very limited form of government under our Constitution of 1789, took We the People's organic document and copied it into the congressional record. Now, why would they do this? What did this accomplish? What purpose did this serve? With no constitutional authority to do so, the Congress created a separate form of government for the District of Columbia, 10 miles square parcel of land. Reference the Acts of the 41st Congress, Section 34, Session 3, Chapters 61 and 62. The Act passed when the country was weakened and financially depleted in the aftermath of the Civil War. It was a strategic move by foreign interests, that is to say specifically international bankers, who were intent upon gaining a stronghold on the coffers and the neck of the American people. Congress cut a deal with the international bankers, specifically the Rothschilds of London, to incur debt to these bankers. And because the bankers were not about to lend money to a floundering nation without serious stipulations, they devised a way to get their foot into the door of the United States of America. The Act of 1871 formed a corporation called the United States. I have a question for you. Are you a United States citizen? The corporation, owned by foreign interests, moved in and basically shoved the original Constitution into a dustbin. With the Act of 1871, the organic Constitution was defaced, in effect vandalized and sabotaged, when the title was capitalized from its original upper and lowercase sensitive expression, and the word for was changed to the word of into the title. Capitalization is not insignificant when one is referring to a legal document. This seemingly minor alteration has had a major impact on every subsequent generation of Americans since then. The Constitution of the United States of America is the Constitution of the Incorporated United States. I repeat that. The Constitution of the United States of America is the Constitution for the Incorporated United States of America. An incorporation, you may find, by the way, on Dun and Bradstreet. It operates in an economic capacity and has been used to fool the people, we the people, into one unknowingly becoming indentured and indebted to this new corporation, the United States, and two, that it governs the republic. Well, my fellow Americans, I want to tell you directly, it does not govern the republic, and it has not indentured the citizens of the several states within the union at all. It's just a corporation like Sears and Roebuck. Now, the Congress, by the way, of the Act of 1871, now had the instrument to create on its own and by and through its own government, in addition to what we the people allowed and permitted the legislative branch of government to create. This modified unconstitutional legislative branch, now over two separate governments, even has its own already made citizens, the 14th Amendment citizen. And it was created just a few years before, and we began to create artificial things like persons and individuals and corporations and so forth. And then for their new creation of persons and individuals, the Congress began to create permission to that which is otherwise illegal. That is to say, they created licenses. And for these persons, it was necessary to get a marriage license, a fishing license, a driver's license, a license to practice medicine, and on and on and on and on. Anything else that you can imagine. And what this did, by you petitioning the government for these licenses, was actually to affirm that you're one of their citizens. This can, by the way, be corrected. And if you've had such things in the past, it's not an issue. It can be dealt with, and PJ prayerfully will be talking about that tonight in part. The Civil War was only partially about ending slavery. However, that was as much of a marketing ploy than it was for its true purpose. One is only to read the published papers of such notables as Abraham Lincoln, who said in the fourth debate with Stephen Douglas at Charleston, Illinois, this is September 18th, 1858, and it said in part, quote, "I will say that I am not, nor ever have been in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races, that I am not now, nor have ever been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be a position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race. And I say upon this occasion, I do not perceive that because the white man is to have the superior position, that the Negro should be denied everything." End quote. This is Lincoln. On an aside, did you know that Lincoln said he didn't want to free the slaves unless they were to be deported? Look up the creation of the African state of Liberia. Liberia is the only black state in Africa never subjected to colonial rule, and it's Africa's oldest republic. It was established on land acquired for freed U.S. slaves by the American Colonization Society, which founded a colony at Cape Mesurado in 1821. The Civil War had far, far more sinister ramifications to it. We the people became very confused about the word people being different from the word persons. In our common language, these words were synonym. But in law, then and now, they are not. In 1901, the Supreme Court of the United States took up what is referred to as the Bidwell decision. Here, for the first time, the term U.S. citizen was defined in law. Remember, this is after the 14th Amendment, and its purpose was only to elevate that which was previously considered to be a two-legged farm animal, a slave, into something called personhood. That is the 14th Amendment. There are three definitions of U.S. citizen. There is the territorial citizen, and there is the state citizen, both jurisdictional statements. There's also a non-jurisdictional U.S. citizen being referenced by others around the world, referring to those who live south of Canada, north of Mexico, west of the Atlantic, east of the Pacific. The territorial citizen is, quote, subject to the Congress, end quote. While the state citizen is still subject to the Congress, however, is limited to legislating over the state citizen, quote, bound by the chains of the Constitution, end quote. Notice the case sensitivity of the word citizen with an uppercase C versus the word citizen with a lowercase C. Have you ever heard of a judge saying, don't bring that Constitution into this courtroom or something like that? Why does the court treat state citizens those as though they were territorial citizens? And that is because you are presumed to be subject to the Congress and without stipulation. Unless you properly are able to rebut the assumption, not by your declarations, but by you keeping the burden of proof upon the state to prove in the court's record you are a federal citizen. That's the only way. Then in the 1930s, the Social Security Act came into existence for these U.S. citizens, which they had created. The Social Security Act was only for the creatures created by the Act of 1871. A few years later, the Buck Act came into existence once again. The Supreme Court of the United States took up the question of what was a U.S. citizen. This has now become known as the Hooven decision. This decision is SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States, once again telling you who you are by way of jurisdiction, what laws apply to you, and who may charge you and how they may charge you. Because we the people ignored this bit of very important information, the trap had been set. All you have to do is step into it by agreeing you're a U.S. citizen or by using terminology that expresses the same. That is to say, you are a person who resides in the state of whatever, state of Illinois, state of California, state of Florida. Also keep in mind that those born well before the Civil War who knew who they were are now dying or have died and have already passed on. The new generation only knew what their parents had taught them, and this is sad. So where does this leave us in respect to the question? It leaves us here. Because of our own lack of knowledge, our ignorance, we don't know to exercise the rights and immunities we enjoy. So if anything, through our collective ignorance, we actually have less rights today to enjoy than our progenitors. So with that having been said, it's my sincere pleasure to turn this call over to PJ. Go ahead, buddy.
Yeah, thank you. It is very interesting to think about scheme that has been laid out to entrap people for the last good 100 years. The when the British basically enter a land, no matter where they go in the world, they pretty much repeat what they did in other lands, and that is pretty much to control them financially, and that's A lot of that has been the reason for our problems in America, is that we've adopted and in some ways even have alliances with the old British system that not we, but certain people. If you cater to their goals, their goals is to control mankind because they believe that mankind must be controlled under a statist system. So if you basically follow the party line, you'll be promoted to various positions. And if you fight it, your chances of being promoted to that position are very slim. I don't think even Ronald Reagan, who I had quite a bit of respect for, I don't think he opposed statism nearly as much as he should have. I think if Michael or I were in a presidential position, that we would have to probably go into a a fortress protected by our own men, and then explain to the American people the great scam that's been taking place, especially since the Federal Reserve System has been introduced. One of the things that could be brought out in such a organization of a godly president in position to actually communicate the truth to the people would be the fact that the average man has no nexus, no relationship, no business with the United States until such business is made. So he can be born and provide a living for himself and his family and own land and have no taxes on anything. Without much difficulty, actually, if the United States would follow the written law that's actually in place today. Because their written laws do not reach out and touch the average American. You have to go into a federal zone, which is 25% of America, and actually growing. I don't think it's shrinking. It's actually growing. If you stay out of that 25%, there is no land jurisdiction nexus, and just don't do any business with them. The sad part is that they brought in the Federal Reserve System because the reason they brought in the Federal Reserve System is because the United States government is not allowed to develop a Federal Reserve System in and by the United States. They have to. This is what's sad. The founding fathers knew that the any type of Federal Reserve System is a ruinous venture. Yet, over the years since 1913 and even prior to that, such systems that are likened to the Federal Reserve System have been put into place. Mostly because of promise of rescuing large number of people groups out of what they would call poverty that was brought on by the military and so forth, which is a complete lie, because if they would have left things alone, natural economics worked things out. And What's really interesting is when the government comes in to help in the economic development, they do develop a very fast increase in activity in commerce, but there is a long backlash, and the wealth is distributed very poorly. For example, just one example that's occurring today, extreme hyperinflation. I think if we continue this way, every 5 years your dollar will be worth half as much. So what that means is if you're extremely wealthy and you're heavily leveraged, you're just maxing out your ability to borrow money, and you've been instructed by provided information through people in the know that hyperinflation is going to continue, and they're going to make sure it continues, the best thing you can do is get out there and borrow as much money as possible and buy as many assets as possible. And in 5, 10, 20 years, you're going to pay them off with much cheaper dollars than you bargained for in the first place, which is actually unequal weights and balances. It's unbiblical. It's a form of theft. It's organized crime. And that's how the wealthy get wealthier. Not all wealthy people, but I'm talking about the extreme wealthy people that caused inflation, that caused depressions, that caused recessions, so that they can leverage themselves to acquire large amounts of wealth for much less than a stable economy would provide to them. So I believe that the most important thing for an American to do is to study the tax laws and challenge if they are required to pay Federal Reserve notes as income tax. I'm making it very simplistic there. I shouldn't do that. But keep the burden of proof on the United States and make them force them to produce the evidence that you're required to file and pay. They don't care if you vote for them, not nearly as much as long as you're paying the Federal Reserve taxes, because that is how they control the vast majority of the nation, is through the Federal Reserve system. They can buy judges, they can buy influence, they can buy votes, they can buy control. Everything they want, they can buy. And it's absolutely destructive to a society. If you saved up quite a bit of money and you have it in the bank, let's say you have $100,000 in the bank, in 5 years it's very possibly going to buy half as much as it could buy today. And your wealth is just being taken out from under you. It's extremely evil, and I just hate it. I hate what I see coming, and you get yourself in a position that's even harder to take that money and go out and buy something, because you've got to go out and buy. When I was younger, farmland was $300 an acre. Now that same farmland is $10,000 an acre, and a great deal of that is inflation. So where do you put your money? They make it hard for you to find a place to put your money. The reason the stock market is climbing so rapidly now is because of inflation. It's not because of the building of wealth. It's because of inflation. It's very, very discouraging. You feel like you're getting wealthier and you're actually gaining less ability to buy products and assets with what you have. So what I encourage people to do is to come aboard with us and challenge the IRS in the United States to produce evidence. You can do it with no risk if you do it properly, with no risk of prosecution, no risk of fines or fees. The worst thing that could happen is the United States and the IRS will send you an assessment and you pay a tax. So, and the truth is that I would guess that 85 to 90% of the people that out of 100 people would not be required to pay any taxes. And that would be a huge stimulus to an economy where the wealth is actually maintained in the control of the people, and they can go out and select which parts of the sector of an economy to spend their dollars. The sad part about the United States going out and selecting where to spend the dollars is it's extremely poorly spent, and a great deal of it is spent just to maintain a vote base from a particular party. It's evil. I just can't believe that the American people even allow this to happen. Most pastors in America never study this, never speak on it, have no interest in learning about it, and it's absolutely shameful, because the Bible speaks a great deal about fiscal responsibility and being a good steward of wealth, and yet the church has been given a bribe to basically get their property tax-free as long as they keep their mouth shut and take on the 501c3 status and don't speak out against the government. That's just shameful. But anyway, come aboard and study with us the ways that we have implemented to challenge the United States through the IRS forms and so forth. and make them produce evidence that you're required to file and pay into the United States coffer through the IRS system. In a nutshell, the Title 26 is a tax that is due from entities that generate income domestically in the United States, which is that 25% of the land that I discussed earlier. If you produce income in that area, you're required to follow their forms and pay income tax on it. Well, they have to prove that you're making money in that federal zone domestically, which is called in the United States. If they can't do that, they have no business requiring, you have no obligation to, and you're not qualified, and you're not eligible to fill out any tax forms for the IRS. IRS is a collection agency for the United States. If you don't do any business with the United States, they have no business collecting anything from you. So, Michael, is there any questions out there?
Well, let's find out. The remedy for questions is press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the monitor that you're listening to or from. You'll see a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or question. Outside the rectangle is request for contact information. Fill that in and then hit submit. And I will be glad to give voice to your comment or your question. First question raised is Harold out of Green Bay. Go ahead, Harold.
Hi, Michael. Hi, PJ.
Howdy.
How long of a process does that take when you're challenging the IRS to prove that they have the right to tax over us? What is there any, from your history, what's the length of time that takes?
Very seldom do you get a document from the IRS that says that you're not required to file or pay a tax. They just leave you alone. Now, occasionally we do have people that get them. It's very rare and pretty extreme situations. They really got to abuse you a lot before you can go into court and push them for that, which some people have. And most of the cases, actually all the cases, are sealed. So what we do is we have a process where you send the proper letters to the proper people, and you can do it by notary presentment. We recommend it by notary presentment so that you have another party involved that could attest to not only who received a letter, but what was in that envelope. So, for example, if you mail a letter to the IRS in a certified envelope, the IRS can just simply get in the witness stand, and they do this. We don't recognize that document. And you'll have one person to testify that, we mailed this document to you on such and such date 5 years ago, and 7 years ago. They usually don't come after you anything more longer than 8 years. And then, but if you use us as a notary presentment, we are an additional witness to and a disinterested party that really looks quite well in front of a jury. Of not only sending that another additional envelope, you send the same thing in as we do, but we send it in also, and we'll testify under affidavit, and if need be, we'll be subpoenaed into court to do so, of the identical document that we can present to the jury. Now, they're scared to death to show a jury what we're actually asking the IRS to provide to our clients. They bend over backwards to stop this in courts, and we're working through processes right now in one of the biggest court cases in America in the IRS arena, forcing them to actually acknowledge that they denied our client due process by
stating before the jury his good faith defense. He had a good faith defense because he presented letters in association and aid by us at the same time for 10 years asking the IRS to assess him so that he would know if he's required to file, if he's eligible to file, if he's qualified to file any tax forms with the IRS in order to establish what possibly is due to the United States. And they just didn't want to have any part of that. So they had to deny our client due process just to and actually what they did is they blocked exculpatory evidence before the jury. This is very serious. We had an individual that had a right to selective vocation in his life. He had a right to make a profit in that vocation and provide for himself and his family, independent of the United States. And the United States is coming in and saying, no, you don't have that right. You don't have a right to make income independent of the United States. You don't have a right to keep all the produce of your efforts. And what we do is we challenge them to prove otherwise. And in his situation, there's no evidence that he elected to become a United States citizen. There's no evidence that he did any business in land that is of the United States. There's no evidence that he did any business under license from the United States. There's no nexus with the United States. So the IRS agent and anybody from the United States, put them on the witness stand and produce the evidence of that he did an act to bring him up to the level of a taxpayer. It's going to be extremely interesting.
So most of this process is done by us, the individual, or your group?
It depends on what your vocation is. It'll vary. And we are improving this thing monthly, little by little. Some of this stuff has been assembled for 45 years, and we haven't really put much pressure on it until recently, because every federal judge in America knows that we're doing this. Every single one of them. Okay. That's what we've been told. And we've known of this process for many years, but we just didn't think it had good timing yet. And now it seems to be a good time to do it for various reasons. Trump in office was one of the biggest reasons we initiated it. And I believe he's going to be back into office. The main thing is that we do have some justices in the place of high-level judges that still believe that the Constitution is a good document and that we should be following it. And the Constitution for the United States does not allow for this entity that we created to turn around and tax the average man, the average American man. They're allowed to tax that which occurs in their jurisdiction. They're not allowed to tax that which is without their jurisdiction. That includes property tax, it includes sales tax, federal tax, state tax, you name it. If it's a tax,
and it doesn't matter,
it could be adjudicated in a U.S. court. They probably don't have authority to do it. Go ahead.
And it doesn't matter. Let's say you owe them money and they got a lien on your house. You can still do the process with that?
Absolutely. It's even more powerful. Because
and
if there's a lien.
And the other question
if
is
a
fire.
Your house, well, let me finish that real quick. If there's a lien in your house, that means that one of their agents has stepped forward and at least simulated an administrative process that is taking your wealth away from you. And
well,
once they do that, once they do that, they can be called into a U.S. court in front of a jury and be forced to produce that evidence that they what did they follow to administratively have authority to do that? Everything they do against you, may it put a tax you, put a lien, garnishment, it's administrative. They have to find a location in written law to be able to do that to you. Go ahead with your question. I hope you
and even get it. and even if the house is inside of a common law trust.
Well, common law trust is independent of the United States. It could common law trust is equivalent to it's not so much the owner of the property. It's it's not so much if it's a trust or a an individual owns it or a legal entity owns it. The main thing is the land jurisdiction.
Okay.
They have to produce evidence of a nexus. Now, let's just say they do produce evidence of a nexus. We can take that so-called evidence and we can go into the Supreme Court and argue, when did that activity, that was a right at one time, how did that get converted into a privilege that's taxable? Mm-hmm. They are scared to death of this stuff. Let's just say that you're a farmer. Where did that get converted into a privilege? Now, if you're farming government land, it's a privilege. But if you're farming land that the government does not own at all in any way, how in the world can that be converted into privilege that can be labeled as a taxable activity? It just cannot. Let's just say that you're a dentist. You know, where we have cases running right now. Where did that activity, that chosen profession, where and how and when and why did it get converted into a privilege at that specific activity? Now, if he's got a dentist practice in the District of Columbia, it's going to be taxable. We're not even going to argue.
Okay.
But if it's in the middle of Iowa and there's no federal land within 100 miles of it, Mr. IRS agent, where's your nexus for taxability there? That make sense to you?
Yeah. And the last question I got is if a person was going to start something like this, and the person passed away, could the wife would the wife be able to handle something like that or not?
That's very likely. Yes.
Very
because,
likely.
All we have to we do not encourage anybody to go into court and argue orally. Never, ever encourage that. If they're in court and the judge asks them a question or the prosecutor asks them a question, we encourage our clients. They're not clients, but they're students.
Yeah, okay.
We encourage our students. We teach the students to consider simply turning to the judge and saying, Your Honor, that is a good question, and I have little knowledge in that topic, and I need time to seek counsel on that, and I'll have an answer to you in written form in 7 days. And it's even better if you can get a written question from them so that we can answer the written question point for point. And a lot of times the judges will do that because the judges – almost all judges, especially federal judges, they are well versed in the value of written debate, written arguments. You present something, and then we can sit down together. They can present something, and then we can sit down and look at it for a couple of days before we even start writing the first words in response. We don't have to stand there in a nervous courtroom and make up something, which people that do that, they will be tricked into triggering key terms, key words that they use to entrap you into having the presumption of a taxability there. It might be the term U.S. citizen, might be resident, might be reside. It might be city, county, state, municipality, the United States. There's probably Michael's even pointed out through his research that the abbreviation is a federal zone. The zip code is a federal zone. They've designed it to hoodwink you 100 different ways. So
yeah, I know.
You never want to answer a question.
Okay.
I don't even care if they ask you your name. Don't answer it. Wait till we can examine that. See, that way we can put a disclaimer in there that the name is not associated with a legal person. The name is passed on to you. It's not a name. What is your
label.
Calling? A calling. You know, we call our dog, you know, and the dog knows. He knows what it is.
Right.
People are the same way. But anyway, we don't want to get caught into the trap of any association with taking on a statutory person because they're taxable. They're governable. Okay.
Okay.
Question?
Thank you so much. No, thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Harold. Before we move on to our next questioner, that's Brian, I do want to comment on a term that Harold used when he asked, well, what if the property is in a common law trust? We think in terms of the common law. As PJ talks about it being the original American common law that we inherited from England, only we made it American. And that, if you go to the very, if there's a volume of books, it's called Your State Statutes, it's printed by Westlaw. They're taupe in color, about three quarters of the way up the binding. You'll have a red ribbon going across, and then the taupe continues on to the top. And in that red ribbon, you'll have in gold lettering what is included in that particular book of these many books that comprise your state statutes. So if you go to the very first book, open it up to the very first few pages, it will say preface to everything that you're getting ready to read. In the preface, it will talk about, quote, this state, end quote, and what law venues it recognizes, and it will list admiralty, bankruptcy, it'll list chancery, it'll list common law with an asterisk, and then the asterisk, when you go down the bottom, it'll say, the common law has been incorporated into this state's statutes, unless otherwise noted, end quote. And, you know, you can look all day long and all night long into next year. I've never found where the exemption has been made. So understand that the common law has been hijacked into the federal zone. And that's where PJ's efforts are so critical, because PJ requires the state, the prosecutor, the opposing counsel, to evidence in the record what is the land jurisdiction. It can only be one of two. It's either land within the freely associated compact states, or it's federal land. It's one or the other. And also to make the opposing counsel evidence on the record the personam jurisdiction. Is this one of the people of the freely associated compact states, or is it a person, a federal person? That's the key. So when you talk about your common law documents, it's been hijacked in that sense. That's why I promote heavily and strongly the ecclesiastical venue, which is also listed right there in the preface. When you get up to the E's, you'll see ecclesiastical. So just like you can't have a murder trial conducted through a bankruptcy court, you can't have a bankruptcy conducted through a chancery court. You can't have most anything conducted in an ecclesiastical court unless a crime has been committed. If the crime has been committed by the ecclesiastical entity, well, then it can be dragged in. So just keep all of that in mind, please. Next is Brian. Go ahead, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, PJ. I guess my question's more in the ecclesiastical realm. I was recently advised, generally, I still need to follow up with the individual on some questions after thinking about it, but that a ministry maybe perhaps did not specify this, but a CRT should not be generating profit considerably like an LLC would. And by that I meant, you know, maybe said ministry wants to generate self-sufficiency for spirituality and has an automation software that could, within their CRT, generate profit based on said market values. Would that be, you know, is that something you've addressed? You know, because they make money via donation, typically, as long as said output of money was being used in rightfully situations. I'm just wondering if you run into that issue before and, or do I need to probably follow up with my advisor again? Does that make sense?
Well, you've got to remember, is the business in land that is of the United States? Is it in their land? Is it income that's created domestically in the United States? If it is, they have a tax right to it. If it's not, they don't have a tax right to it. If you have a corporation or LLC or anything else, association, whatever, I don't think that's really the issue. Is where was the business? Where did the business occur? Let's say you have a LLC and it sells lemonade in the District of Columbia on Tuesday, and Wednesday it sells lemonade on another street corner that's outside of District of Columbia. Okay, we got one LLC. Okay, which business was taxable? If it's in the District of Columbia, it's taxable. If it's outside the District of Columbia, it's not taxable. So they have to produce evidence of taxability, and that they'd have to have the evidence that you did business in their land. I don't think it's an all that big of an issue is if it's LLC or not. It's where the activity took place. If you're speeding, it's where the activity took place means everything. And I think if you're fishing, where are you fishing?
Would that extend to the said exchanges or locations where you were connecting to that were actually performing said exchanges, maybe?
Well, it's the business activity. I don't know. Exchanges, you don't make a profit during an exchange.
That's where capital gains take an effect, depending on your persona that is being applied to.
Yeah, they have to prove that though. Then you have the rest of your life to examine that. But very, very simplistically, you know, if you have a fishing license from the federal government, but you go out fishing, if you fish in their land, it very well may apply. If you don't fish in their land, it doesn't make if you have a fishing license in your pocket or not.
Right, right.
The 1040 tax form is very clear. It says income generated by a person domestically in the United States. So if it doesn't line up with that, it's not taxable. But we're not the ones that's going to say it's taxable or not. We just simply ask the IRS agent to produce that evidence that it's taxable.
Right.
Some people say, oh, you're using Federal Reserve notes as taxable. Okay, Mr. IRS agent, get in the witness chair and produce the evidence to support your claim. Well, you have a Social Security number. Okay, get in the witness chair, produce the evidence that supports your claim. All that stuff is, we've been in IRS, we've been in courts many, many times. All that stuff comes up. And if you challenge it properly, the IRS agent goes, I don't know. I don't have anything to support it. The judge knows that if he can't support it, it's not supposed to be entertained by the jury. He's got to support it right there and then. If he says you're a taxpayer and you go, well, what evidence do you have that I'm a taxpayer? Because taxpayer is a statutorily defined person. Okay, you're saying I'm a taxpayer. What evidence do you have that I'm a taxpayer? Well, you have a Social Security number. Well, what evidence do you have having a Social Security number converts me into a taxpayer? Well, it's very interesting.
It sounds like it's even harder in the ecclesiastical realm. Would that be true?
Well, you got to be careful. You don't try to develop something fancy on your side of the fence. You start doing that, and the jury's going to think something suspicious going on here. You can do it somewhat, but they have to produce evidence that what occurred over there is taxable. They have to produce that evidence. They don't care if you're at a Bible study or if you're making sawed-off shotguns. They might not have a nexus on either one of them.
Right, right.
But they might.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in on that. The ideal position for anyone to be in and everyone to be in is to own nothing and control everything. The IRS has a term for somebody who is flat broke, and they call you simply uncollectible. If you have your properties in trusts, plural, or single trust, whatever, and the trustee is a corporation sole, or the trustee could be your very best, most trusted friend. Doesn't matter. You shouldn't be the trustee. Even though you're allowed to through a ecclesiastical trust, a charitable religious trust, even though that's allowed, and it's not allowed in civil trusts or statutory trusts, but it is allowed in ecclesiastical trusts. But you don't want the appearance. So you use a corporation sole as the trustee, which you manage, so you still have total control of it, but you don't own it, and you get to a place where the only thing that they can come after is your body and put your body in jail if they're able to, but there's nothing they can take from you. So by having it in the ecclesiastical venue as opposed to the civil venue, a civil venue invites attorneys, it invites controversy and litigation. If it's in an ecclesiastical trust, there are no attorneys involved, and people like PJ can step in and actually defend in court as if he were an attorney, simply by being the special agent with limited powers of attorney to defend the trust. And he, PJ does this with other students that he has who have home foreclosure issues. And because the homeowner gave the property away to a trust and named PJ as the trustee, PJ has every right to walk into that courtroom. And he doesn't walk into the courtroom. He does everything by mail. But if he needed to, he actually could appear and sit there and introduce himself. So the key is that if you use trusts and you can use ecclesiastical trusts, you're in the best position where you own nothing. Now it just comes down to the fight that PJ is talking about on this call, which is regarding keeping you out of jail. And if you're kept out of – the only thing that they can put you in jail is for criminal activity. And they lost that a long time ago with simple arguments that PJ has. Back to you, PJ.
Yeah, if you're writing them a letter every year – and you're mailing it in, certified green card, and you have we do it as a notary for you, certified green card, and we keep, and then those letters are almost identical year to year. We just change the dates on it, and they try to prosecute you. How in the world are they going to prove intent in front of a jury? What are you talking about? I've been asking you for 10 years. Am I required to file? Am I required to pay? It doesn't. We have one client right now that he did file, he did pay, he did send in those letters every year. Now we're challenging that. How can you guys claim he had a requirement to file when you never did answer the question if he had a requirement to file? They go, well, he filed. No, he can't file unless he's qualified, eligible, required. You can't pull that on us. You can't say you come right in here right now, and then when you walk in the door, they, oh, well, you came in. We got jurisdiction. No, they can't do that. We've had situations where an individual was told to appear into an IRS case, and we instructed the guy to tell the U.S. Marshals to come over and get him so that they wouldn't have personal jurisdiction over him when he challenged personal jurisdiction. So they intentionally didn't come over to get him from the coffee shop across the street from the federal courthouse. So he just sat there, and he started. We instructed him, no matter what, do not go to the center of the street and go over there, because they own the land from the center of the street towards the courthouse. They own the whole block. No matter what, make sure that U.S. Marshal comes over there and walks with you, meets you at the coffee shop, and walks you into the courthouse. And the guy got nervous, and the U.S. Marshal hollers at him and said, hey, Bill, hurry up, you're late, get over here. And he just, okay, he runs over there. And the judge ended up asking him, you know, where did you meet the U.S. Marshal? Oh, in front of the courthouse here. The judge is simply, we got personal jurisdiction. Next. So just think about this. What they do to now, every one of our documents, we've got a disclaimer in there so that they cannot use that document to create any form of jurisdiction. Lawyers have really said, wow, that is really pretty creative how you've done that. That's very interesting.
And PJ, I wanted to add that, you know, this goes right back to consent. And the same thing that everybody does on web forms every day, and just, oh yeah, I consent. I don't want to read that. And the guy at the coffee shop consented, you know, to go over to the federal jurisdiction. So just wanted to add that.
Yeah. Now that didn't give them personal jurisdiction, but it gave the, a little prima facie evidence of it. And we had to fight to get him out of there. But, the Constitution says the only way the United States government can get authority over you is by consent. If you go into a federal zone and rob a bank or do an activity, rob something from the Federal Reserve System or whatever, That's a consensual activity. Nobody forced you to rob that bank, so that's consent. If you go and do business in a federal zone, that's consent. Now, if you're a dentist and you're never in a federal zone, guess what? There may be no evidence of consent. And maybe they can't tax you. And maybe they're in big trouble because that's the number one vote they want from you. That's the number one vote they want from you, is they want 30% of your income. That's a pretty big vote. I would rather stay home instead of vote that. Anyway, next question.
Brian, anything else?
No, sir. Thank you. That was most excellent.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Well, we've gone a bit over time here. That's surprising. PJ's usually pretty prompt, going, oh, time's up. Got to go. Just teasing. There is Anita and there is Jennifer on the call. We tried to put a call together today. John, an associate of PJ's, was not able to make it to get on the call today. So we're trying again for tomorrow, just to let you know. And so, you know, you're on the list to be called. We got your number. So I want to thank you for joining us tonight, everybody. And until next week, good night and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.